and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening in. My guest today is Charles Marone. He's the founder and president of Strong Towns, a nonprofit advocacy organization focused on the financial predicament that local governments find themselves in as a result of America's suburban experiment. Chuck has a bachelor's degree in civil engineering from the University of Minnesota's Institute of Technology and a master's in urban and regional planning from the University of Minnesota's Humphrey Institute. And his website is strongtowns.org. You can find him there. And without further ado, here's my conversation with Chuck Marone.
You know that I used to be in bands. I played drums, and I always played in bands till my kids were born. Mm-hmm. And when you're the drummer, you're the guy who has to stand up there and go, check, one, two, three.
Oh, yeah, right. Here we go.
Let's do it.
I'm with Chuck Marone of strongtowns.org. He's talking to me from Brainerd, Minnesota. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
We're going to be talking about what you do and what you see around the Midwest in particular. You know, the message that's being put out by the authorities these days is that the U.S. economy is strong, at least strong enough for an interest rate hike coming in a week or two. And what's your view of middle America from the heart of middle America there in Minnesota? How's the economy doing, and how are the folks doing out there?
Well, I think we've been able to manufacture a certain what we call at Strong Towns, the illusion of wealth. We certainly see the mantra, you know, if you're not growing, you're dying. And the places that have been able to get the big box stores, the strip malls, the residential subdivisions that have kind of been the byproduct of this loose money, the zero interest rate policy, mm-hmm. those places have seen not a robust kind of recovery, but they've seen a stabilization of their funds. I work a lot with local governments, and local governments had this delayed effect where, you know, in 2008, 2009, things were tough for them, but things got really tough in 2010 and 11 when the property tax receipts and that kind of stuff started to reflect the overall malaise in the economy. A lot of the money that was poured into local governments and poured into these projects and poured into stabilizing housing prices have given cities a little bit of time to avoid dealing with some of those really traumatic financial issues they were being forced to deal with just a half dozen years ago.
Well, in your blogs, you've actually made the point that many, many, many more cities, maybe a preponderance of American cities, are actually quite bankrupt. Well, they use accounting tricks to cover that up.
There's no doubt. I mean, I've said that almost every U.S. city is bankrupt, insolvent from a balance sheet standpoint. I want to make sure that I'm clear. I don't mean bankrupt as in they can't pay their bills today. What I mean is that when you add up all the things they promised to do, we'll fix this pipe, we'll maintain this road, and you add up all of the potential sources of income that they have, there is no way those two come anywhere close to balancing. We did a really detailed analysis in the city of Lafayette, Louisiana. We, being Joe Minicozzi from Urban 3 and myself, what we found there was that the typical taxpayer pays around $1,000 a year to the city in property taxes, in total taxes, in order for them to actually maintain everything that the city has promised they'll maintain. That would have to go to $8,000 a year. So from $1,000 to $8,000, that will never happen. And what the implications of that is that there's a lot of stuff that just will never be maintained. It can't be fixed because there'll never be the money to fix it.
Yeah, we've basically just overbuilt ourselves, right?
Well, you've said this for years. You said, you know, the largest misallocation of wealth in human history. And what we've done is we've just built ourselves into decline. We build this way. It creates for us this short-term illusion of wealth. It makes us feel very wealthy. When you can have a developer finance the extension of the sewer and the water and the government grant pay for the frontage road and the DOT pay for the interchange, as a local government, you're just making money. Those liabilities don't come due for 10, 20, 30, sometimes even more mm-hmm. period of time. But when they come due and you sit and you look around and you say, wow, now we've got these 30, 40-year-old strip malls here that are supposed to generate the wealth to pay to fix all this stuff. And you just it's patently obvious that it can't happen. It will never happen.
Well, what kind of shape is that stuff in the upper Midwest where you are? I mean, now you live amongst all that stuff, and what do you observe about the condition of it and whether, you know, I wonder whether the people up there have any sense that suburbia and all of its furnishings and accessories are played out, simply played out.
It's funny because there are urbanist movements of people who, for lifestyle preferences and what have you, are pushing a renaissance of urban areas. Minneapolis is turning into, and I say that turning into because I don't think it has been historically in the last couple of decades, but it's becoming a beautiful place. And parts of Minneapolis are becoming truly spectacular. I think you can say the same thing about St. Paul. There's some smaller towns. I would not count my town of Brainerd among them, but there are some smaller towns around the Midwest, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa has got some beautiful ones, mm-hmm. where they're having a similar kind of renaissance.
I got to stop you and interrupt you because the last time I was in Minneapolis, I was staying at a hotel at the end of Hennepin, yeah. which is one of the major, you know, downtown streets. And I experienced the town as being really kind of empty and just vacant.
There's no doubt that I think some of those core places certainly have that feel. There are when I say Minneapolis is going through a renaissance, there are areas like Uptown, which, you know, when I went to college in the 90s in Minneapolis was just a terrible. It was a place you would never have gone. And now it's one of the kind of nicer places. It's tough to get a place there. They're very expensive. It's got a lot of great restaurants, a lot of, you know, 24-hour nightlife. It's a great little part of town. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that kind of micro stuff going on mm-hmm. that is not, you know, the towers and the skyscrapers and the big fancy stuff.
And the skywalks in particular, which have really
the hamster
killed
runs,
the streets.
You call them, right?
Yeah, the hamster, the gerbil runs, those bridges between the buildings off the street. You know, to this day, they still really damage the life of the street.
And I think it's questionable whether those places can be brought back you know, without some heroic type of intervention.
Yeah.
But you see in other parts of the city that, you know, where there is the ability to make these smaller improvements and make the street a little bit better, the neighborhood a little bit better, those things are starting to happen.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there's any sentiment in the upper Midwest for restoring or improving passenger rail.
No. And I say that, I'm sure there's people listening who are involved in trying to do that. But as a dominant notion, it's not. We're still very much, you know, in Minnesota, we tried to pass a $10 billion program to do mostly road building. And they did the stuff where they bribed the bike ped people with a little bit of money, and they bribe the transit people by saying you get this commuter rail system. But nobody's seriously talking about a shift from the auto-based economy and that whole Ponzi scheme of growth that we described. Mm-hmm. No one's talking about shifting from that to something fundamentally different. It's just it's not part of the conversation.
Yeah, and I imagine it's going to get worse because for the moment we're back in the cheap gasoline era. And you know, my take on the oil situation is simply that the public is confused, and the picture that is presented by what's going on in the oil industry is a confusing picture. You know, the public's been told that shale oil will allow them to drive to Walmart forever, and you know they don't understand the carnage that's going on in the shale oil industry right now, which, you know, none of these guys can make any money at $38 a gallon or a barrel, excuse me, where we are now. They're, you know, they're going to start going bankrupt. They're not going to be able to pay back their bondholders. They're not going to get new bond financing to do all the drilling that they got to do just to keep production flat. And, you know, I think that it's going to be pretty consequential when people wake up and discover that this too was just another Ponzi scheme.
it's fascinated me. You know, North Dakota, I've done a number of talks across the border here. And when you look at the way the economy here has been shaped by North Dakota, when things were really disastrous here from a housing standpoint, a lot of the people just left and went and worked there. They would get up Monday morning and they would drive to North Dakota and they would do surveying and they would do engineering and they would do all the stuff that people have been doing here for the kind of junky home building stuff we were doing. That whole industry just migrated west. We had a nanny for my little kids. We had a nanny who actually went out and lived in a camper out there with her boyfriend because he was working in the oil fields making, you know, 60, 70, 80,000 a year, something like that. Mm-hmm. That is all, I won't say that's all gone, but oh my gosh, it is not part of the conversation here anymore. A lot of those people have come back. A lot of that has been wound down, and you don't get the intensity. Part of it's because things have, you know, that illusion has gotten a little bit better here. But a lot of it is because it's the demand side of being able to do it out there is just not around. On the way in today, we had gas at $1.87 a gallon.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm with you when I see these guys paying 4-5% interest rates on something that is just bizarrely risky. You know, because people are chasing yield and they see this as like the safe bet.
You're talking about bond, you know, you're talking about the junk bonds that junk bond financing that the shale oil industry was running on.
Well, yeah, I mean, this would be in any normal market a junk bond. In fact, they might even be called junk bonds now. Are. But, you know, junk bonds, which, and I think a real world would be paying double digit interest rates, are you know, 4.5-5%.
Right. What you used to get in just a plain old bank account or a certificate of deposit.
Right. Right. Exactly. When I was growing up, you could put your money in the bank and get 4-5%.
Yeah. You know, but now you get that plus all the risk of owning a janky bond.
Yeah. Something that, you know, is very likely to blow up. And when you talk about the misallocation of wealth, I mean, this is the mechanics of it, right? You have people, whether it's pension funds or whether it's, you know, people near retirement or people younger who are just trying to get some type of return on their investment. When they can't get anything beyond 0.2%, which is what my daughter's savings account is yielding 0.2%. When you can't get anything beyond that in a savings account, people go looking for places to put money that pays a return. And what you see is that people wind up in these crazy schemes, which is what a lot of what's going on in North Dakota is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it drives capital to things that really should be marginal efforts.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of stuff in the news about, you know, apartment complexes that were that got under construction in North Dakota and were abandoned. You know, when the price of oil dropped beginning in the fall of 2014. And, you know, the landscape is now littered with unfinished apartment complexes along with all the shale oil drilling pads.
Well, and the tragic part of it from a Dakota standpoint is that not only do you have the environmental disruption, which is very real, you've also got this economic disruption. They can't figure out how to pay for the roads. They can't figure out how to make, I mean, this, mm-hmm. the equipment just destroys everything. They can't figure out how to keep it all going.
The trucks and, that you're referring to on the roads. Yeah.
Yeah. You drive. You part of the North Dakota experience is that, you know, you've got this long part of the year where everything's frozen up. Mm-hmm. And then you go through this thaw, and that thaw period of time lasts sometimes a long time. And you can't drive anything heavy on any road when it's thawing.
Well, it thaws and then refreezes and then thaws again, and that really beats up the landscape.
Yes, and not only do you have that swelling that comes with the freezing water underneath, but the problem is that the ground doesn't freeze from the bottom up; it freezes from it thaws from the top down. Mm-hmm. So you'll have 6 inches of just wet, mucky mud on top of, you know, bed, basically like granite because it's frozen solid ice. Yeah. And what happens is the roads just squish in that with the huge trucks, and it just rips them apart. And so they're finding that they can't keep it maintained. They can't keep this stuff financially going just from a local government standpoint. you lay over top of that the kind of social cultural dynamics of this. I mean, there have been multiple series on the man camps, you know, in the local paper here on the man camps and the prostitution and the drug abuse and kind of some of the nastier stuff that you see going on up there. And it's becoming untenable in many different dimensions.
Chuck, we're going to take a break for 10 seconds. I'm going to let the cat in.
Let the kitty in.
Okay. Scooter is in the house.
Sweet.
Chuck, it seems to me that we're facing pretty stiff capital scarcity problems going forward, despite the financial antics of the central banks and the governments. And do you see any awareness of that in your part of the world?
No, I don't. And the fascinating thing is if you go back to 2008, you know, and I'm with you on the long emergency. I mean, this is going to take a long time to work itself out in many ways. But if you would have told me that we were going to print trillions of dollars and you know, allocate it the way that we wound up doing it, I would have said that's insane. I mean, this whole economy will melt down. And you look, and there's a part of me that says, okay, I can see that this bridge is really fragile. And I can see that everything we've done is to make it even more fragile. Yet I'm looking around at everybody and they're still driving over it. They're still, you know, driving over it like it was not a big deal at all. And, you know, the housing market here continues to churn. It's been a little bit of a slowdown. But, you know, you've got the city government here going into hawk for millions of dollars to build, you know, new systems that they think will create growth. You've got the neighboring city who is going to spend millions of dollars punching through a new kind of parallel highway to the highway that's already there because they anticipate in 30 years there'll be additional congestion. And so, no, it seems like nobody learned a darn thing from what happened in 2008. And our obsession is just kind of getting back to those heydays, the way things were.
Well, what do you observe? You do a lot of consulting. And what do you observe about the competence of the city and town officials that you consort with out there these days, especially vis-a-vis the urban design issues?
Yeah, I used to do a lot of consulting. I have to say, as part of the kind of evolving mission of Strong Towns, I haven't done any consulting work for a few years, but we do a lot of workshops and a lot of...
community events, right?
Yeah, stuff with cities and with city officials. I will say that in some places, there is a growing awareness among the population that things need to change. And there are, you know, bright lights here and there amongst city staff of individuals who get that, you know, the approach needs to be different. But the problem you've got is really one of the incentives, I think, inside these systems. If you create, as we have with government, systems that have really strong sense of hierarchy, the decisions are siloed into different departments. It's really hard to break out and do something as thoughtful and as kind of integrated intellectually as good urban design. You know, that requires, first of all, someone who gets urban design on staff, which is a very rare thing in cities. But then it requires that person be able to essentially trump the kind of petty, you know, concerns of the traffic engineer,
the economic development guys,
the guy who counts parking stalls. you know, our bureaucracies have empowered all these people, and really, this is not an anti-government rant. If you go back to the 1950s, businesses went this route too. They looked at the lessons of World War II and the Depression, and they said the way we efficiently deliver service and product is to create these hierarchies and silos, and we'll have, you know, a division of this and a division of that. And what they found is that, you know, by the time you get to the 70s and 80s, yes, you can produce things really efficiently, but you don't have any innovation. And businesses tended to then evolve to a flatter structure. In government, that never happened. And it never happened, you can say, because of unions, or you can say because of, you know, the nature of government or what have you. I just... it, for whatever reason, it never happened. And governments have these antiquated structures that are just not really good at adaptation and innovation. And that stifles a lot of the changes that we see that need to happen at the local government level.
Uh-huh. Well, both of us are members of the Congress for the New Urbanism. And we've been watching the scene from that perch for a while. And that's an umbrella organization for people who are interested in improving the American living arrangement and specifically making our towns better towns. And the movement itself, the New Urbanist movement, as represented in the CNU, seems kind of stuck and rudderless to me at the moment. What's your take on it?
I struggle with that too. And, you know, I owe a huge debt of gratitude to the people in the CNU because intellectually they helped me a lot when I was trying to figure things out. I mean, mm-hmm. in my days as an engineer back in the 90s and early 2000s, and then when I worked for a number of years as a planner, when I would run into problems and I couldn't figure something out, I would research it and I would always wind up back at the CNU because they had figured it out.
Uh-huh.
There's a sense now, and actually a conversation going on within the CNU, as the organization won. I mean, as it essentially like done what it set out to do and now should just go away. Uh-huh. And I find that conversation fascinating because in a way what CNU did was resurrect a body of thought that had been just thrown on the trash heap, that had just been lost. And while that body of thought is not the predominant body of thought in the nation today, it's not going away again. I mean, this is recaptured knowledge now that enough people are aware of and get and are pushing to have integrated into what we do that I think you can make a case that the CNU won. Like they did it, what they set out to do. I think part of the struggle with what comes next is actually saying, you know, what is the purpose of this intellectual movement now that we've actually done the hard work of resurrecting these ideas? And I don't really know. I don't think they know. It's still a fun place to go and hang out. And I still get a real charge out of, you know, once a year running into all these people who are just great intellectual thinkers. But beyond the Congress, yeah, I kind of struggle with, you know, what comes next for the CNU. And I'm not sure there's an answer that anyone's come up with yet.
Yeah, I have a couple of ideas that have been twanging on me lately. And one of them is, you know, my new theory of history, which is that things happen because they seem like a good idea at the time. And that kind of redounds to another idea that's been twanging on me for quite a while, which is that American life probably isn't going to change until circumstances compel us to make those changes. And then we'll do what seems to be a new thing at the, you know, a new thing that seems like a good idea at the time. And maybe some of those ideas will be the ones that came out of the New Urbanist movement.
I couldn't agree more. It's fascinating to me because I will hear people say, well, Chuck, you know, you're saying cities are going broke. I'll come back and say cities, you know, we're adaptable. Humans are adaptable and Americans have a lot of ingenuity and we'll overcome. And I say, yeah, I totally agree with that. We will look back and see this stress and then we'll see how people use their ingenuity to overcome it. That doesn't mean that we can defy the laws of physics. That doesn't mean that we can defy, you know, some basic economic principles. It means that we will be forced to make some hard decisions, and here's how we'll do it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that might drive that is that sooner or later we're going to have to contend with the problem of the contraction of techno-industrial societies. And that leads to the question of, what is the nature of the economy that follows that? But it also means, you know, how do we manage that contraction in terms of, you know, the urban landscape?
And this is what I do think that the great contribution of the new urbanists is and will be, and I think hopefully will historically be recorded as such. When we get to that point of being forced to change and to do something differently, it was Churchill said, you can count on the Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else, right?
They've exhausted all the other possibilities.
Yeah. The thing is that without the new urbanists, I don't know as we would have that right thing necessarily in the toolbox.
Right.
And what they've done is they've put it back in the toolbox and hopefully have given us, you know, a decade or two head start on doing things that are actually viable. And when we get to the point where we give up on the suburban experiment and we give up on the way we've been building and financing growth, I think a lot of those principles will be things that will have now had some road testing, now had some, you know, some miles underneath them in a sense in a modern context. Uh-huh. And you won't be talking about, well, do you want a horse and buggy and sewage in the street or do you want, you know, bankruptcy? There's an option now where we can grab the best principles from the past and hopefully modernize them without having to go too far backward.
Yeah, well, I agree with you completely. You know, I've traveled around the United States for decades, and I've seen an awful lot of the country. I go to places that a lot of civilians don't get to go. You know, the back roads of Arkansas, or, you know, driving from Minneapolis to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, you know, things like that. And I'm always amazed at the stupefying ugliness of Midwestern towns. But especially as they've evolved after the Second World War, you know, you see remnants of some pretty good stuff, you know, at the old town centers. But most of the time, it's been obliterated, and it's as though some of the worst tendencies of American culture are amplified there in the Midwest. All the bad choices, all the shortcuts, all the fakery, and especially the total absence of artistry in our surroundings. How do you account for that in the Midwest?
I'll actually make a cultural comment on top of that too, because I think the stunning thing about it is that we're actually proud of it.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like that Sinclair Lewis Babbittry, you know, phenomenon that he described in the 1920s.
It's funny because I can picture you in a car, because I've done this as well. I was in Bloomington, Illinois once, and they were driving around showing me stuff that they were really proud of, and I thought, oh my gosh, you please tell me that you're not proud of this.
Calling an airstrike.
Yeah. No, these are very good people, and they really care about their places. But yeah, it's a little bit bewildering.
It's mystifying to me.
It's mystifying.
Because I agree with you. I think that, you know, in many ways they are good people, but they have this this amazing appetite for that immersive ugliness that I tend to describe as entropy made visible.
Yeah. I do. It's funny because I think the easy part of me, the part of me that is going to just address this without any intellectual rigor, says we need people to travel more. You know, when your travel sphere in a normal year is from Brainerd to the Mall of America, you know, you're not exactly getting a broad palette of things in which to judge your own environment by.
Yeah.
So, you know, that you come off as elitist when you say that here in the Midwest, and I'm certainly not trying to suggest that I'm some worldly person, but I do think that part of it is that part of it is you see the world around you, you compare, they've got a nicer Olive Garden than we do. Let's put brick siding on our next, you know, half fake rock siding on three parts of the building, cause that'll look a little bit better than ours.
Yeah.
You know, you get that kind of, introspection here. I will say
that's the pretty shallow introspection.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I will say that I'm a little bit more optimistic on the Midwest than when I go west of here, like the Mountain West just, you know, depresses me, because even when people get it there, the physical layout of those places and the remoteness of them, yeah, and the this huge disparity between what is financially viable and what they've actually built.
Yeah.
It just says to me, I don't see how these places have a next generation.
Yeah. They lack even an older template. There is no cultural memory of an earlier template because the earlier template didn't exist.
Right.
Everything is, really post-World War II suburban sprawl crapola.
Exactly. So I was in Allentown last week in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm, and here's a place that is starting to do some things that I think are really good and actually has many, many, many neighborhoods that are just neglected today that could easily be brought back. Mm-hmm. We have a very small amount of those here in the Midwest, mm-hmm, and much greater struggle, but we actually have the framework that you could start to build those kind of places on. And that gives me a little bit of hope. You go further west and you don't even have that. I mean, you just have a block of museum piece surrounded by just miles of stuff that has no future.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I saw that most recently in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Yeah.
Which had about, 1.5 blocks of old urban fabric surrounded by this gigantic supernova of crap. And that's normal.
I had to laugh because I was in Sacramento, California. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've ever been there.
But oh, yeah, plenty of times.
Okay. They have that. It's literally a museum piece. They have their like old, they might call it Old Town or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But it's, they got the wood sidewalks and you get sarsaparilla and.
Oh,
I haven't
seen that. No.
Oh, yeah. No, it is actually a museum. And that's their original town. Uh-huh. And then, yeah, it is just surrounded by the worst of the worst for an hour in every direction.
Yeah, although I must say that, there are neighborhoods in the center of Sacramento that are okay. And there was one particular street that struck me. It was kind of, I think it was only a one block long street off of a park that the state capitol building was on.
Yeah.
And, it looked like a real urban place. I think there was even an apartment building with a canopy, which sort of was, looked a little bit like an eastern city.
Yeah.
But it was
two blocks from an urban highway that ran
exactly,
exactly. The middle of
so
it.
So little
you know.
Of it.
Yeah.
Well, I do wonder because when I've been around these Midwestern towns, and I've been through a lot of them, I'm often drawn to looking for like the historic postcards or some sign of the cultural memory of what the town was originally. And of course, a lot of these places, were brand new in, after 1865.
Right.
You look at a historic photo of Sioux Falls in 1880, and you realize, all that stuff is less than 25 years old.
Yeah.
And now it's all gone, of course. But is there any cultural memory of the stuff that was built originally that was pretty good?
I'm going to give you a really sad story. Uh-oh. So, there's a photo that I came across here from 1870 in my hometown in Brainerd that is the original pop-up street. So you have the little shacks all along, maybe like a dozen of them with a bunch of like lumberjacks and their suits, right? Standing uh-huh. out, getting their photo taken. And that was the first iteration of Brainerd. I came across this photo at the pizza place in the mall.
Oh,
so
wow.
you go to the mall, right? And this is the mall that was built in 1985. We actually call this one, well, I do, the new mall, because the old mall was built in the 60s out on the other side of town. So this is the new mall, and the new mall has this, mall pizza place. And inside the pizza place are all these old pictures of what the town used to look like, including this one from 1870. And there's what the park used to look like, and it had, Roman columns around a reflecting pool. All that's gone, right? Yeah. It has the old Front Street, which is the main street one block off the railroad, with a circus parade going through and all these people lining the street and just the shops and stuff. It's all parking lot now, strip mall. It's gone. So they actually paid to have someone come in and paint murals on the upper walls of this thing. It's a vaulted ceiling of the old historic building. So here's a mural of the old post office, you know, ripped out in the 1970s and is now a parking lot. Here's a mural of the old movie theater in the downtown, ripped out in the 1980s and is now a parking lot. So there's this cultural memory that's captured at the mall pizza place.
Uh-huh.
And really,
that's a strange storage place for it.
Yes, in the mall itself is you know dead. Mm-hmm. They've tried to do some things to revive it, but you know they can't keep good tenants in there, and it really struggles badly.
Have the wig shops moved in?
We're not quite to that spot yet. We do have like the U-Haul place has moved in there and does their stuff out of it. And, you know,
the place that sells apparel to motorcycle thugs.
Yeah. We got that.
Hey, Chuck, I don't know if you remember this. You were probably a child when this came out, but there was this marvelous book that came out in 1970, just around the time I got out of college, called Wisconsin Death Trip, by Michael Lesey, L-E-S-E-Y, who was a graduate student at the time that, and this was his master's thesis, but it was published as a commercial trade book. And Wisconsin Death Trip by Lesey was all about a trove of photographs that were found in some attic in Black River Falls, Wisconsin. And they were all taken by the guy who was the town photographer in a period between like 1885 and 1912 or something. And they depicted the emptying out of the small Midwestern towns as people moved to Chicago and Milwaukee to move to live, work in the factories. And the small towns emptied out, and there were few people left except for the incompetent, the insane, and the unmovable. And are you familiar with that book at all?
I'm not. I was born in 73, so that was a little bit
you
little
weren't
bit
even
before
a child.
Me. Yeah.
Anyway, I recommend that book, and it's an interesting gloss on really what happens during a certain period of history, really. And it should be a reminder to us that, you know, what we see around us for the moment is what history is doing for the moment, and you know, history moves on. And I maintain that actually the action in America is going to be moving back to the smaller towns and the smaller cities, and that we're going to have an awful lot of trouble with the contraction of the big cities and the sort of the fights and battles that are going to go on around that issue of contraction. So how do you feel about that?
I'm with you on that aspect of it. I do think that when I look at our small towns, we have 854 cities in Minnesota. And I wrote a report about 5 or 6 years ago that said over half of them are wards of the state. And by that I meant they would not exist except for the aid that is given to them every year by the state of Minnesota. Uh-huh. And that aid is a legacy of a period of time when the rural legislators controlled the government and essentially voted themselves subsidies. Mm-hmm. Now you have the control of the legislature shifting to the urban areas and, you know, more of the urban kind of suburb mix. And rural areas are finding themselves in a really difficult spot because without the ongoing, with literally tens of thousands of dollars a year, which is, you know, for some of these cities, half their budget mm-hmm. is state aid. These places don't exist. Mm-hmm. When you look at a lot of these places, you know, the growth industry 20 years ago was moving or you know, building manufactured houses. And then, you know, the growth industry in the last decade has been building senior housing. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming the growth industry in the next decade will be mortuary services.
Yeah, cemeteries.
Cemeteries, right. And then, you know, what comes after that? Mm-hmm. So,
well, I think what comes after that is that, you know, as I've said in my own podcast before, that the places that are close to food production and good farmland are going to take on a lot more value than they have now.
I totally agree with you. I struggled to figure out how, in the sense that, like right now, if you had 100 young people, and I say that, I mean, they could be of any age, but I'm thinking, you know, people who wanted to have kind of an upstart life, go out, you know, work a farm, live in a town, do that kind of thing. There are cities all over the Midwest that you could just take, you know, a colony of 100 people to and go and move in and you know, completely run the place because mm-hmm. you would be the only energy there. You would be the only people there with any capital. You would be you'd be able to buy a house for $20,000 and you'd have state-of-the-art infrastructure because the government's provided all that. And you'd essentially have a generation to get things going.
Well, I kind of wonder if that's not going to happen. You know, I think it actually might.
It might. I think we would have to, you know, culturally things would have to change quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could tell you a real fascinating story about some work I did back in the 90s with some Hasidic Jews in Brooklyn, if it's not too much of a diversion. They actually, if you're familiar with Williamsburg a little bit, because you grew up there.
And not Williamsburg. I grew up in New York City, but not Williamsburg.
Right, but you grew up in New York, so you're familiar
Although
with...
When I was a kid there, going to Brooklyn was like going to Czechoslovakia. It was so remote. And, you know, nobody I knew lived there. It was really quite a different scene. But well, anyway, go ahead.
Imagine yourself a small town planner in like 2002 working in rural Minnesota, and you get a call from a Hasidic Jew community in Brooklyn who tells you, we have too much population growth here. We're going to go build a new city in Kansas. We want you to do it for us.
Whoa. That's a wild call.
I'll spare you all the details. It never came to fruition, but it introduced me to a whole bunch of people who are just been fascinating. And I've gotten to know, I've stayed in touch with some of them. They're beautiful people in many ways, but the logistics of moving essentially 5,000 was going to be the first wave of Hasidic Jews. And I'll use their term, all the Jew infrastructure that would have to go along with that. Was just overwhelmed.
What is that, delicatessens and synagogues? Or?
Well, and, you know, kosher foods and culturally you have the
art
whole...
Art museums, symphony halls.
Well, I think the big one was the rabbinical ties. I mean, these guys, you know, had their own religious connections.
Yeah.
And when you're, you know, out in a remote place, how do you keep in touch with your peers within your, you know, your stream of pursuit? So it became like logistically, as I started to kind of go through things with them, their dreams of making this come true kind of ran into a hard reality. I wonder though, could a more, because there's a part of me that says, if you're going to do this, if you're going to occupy these kind of places, it would be like a homogeneous group like this that would go do it. You know, just logistically doing it to me seemed like it would be easier to do logistically if it was a more spontaneous thing that didn't require like a homogeneous set of people to do it. So
I think those spontaneous things take the form of really what might be called cultural tropisms.
Where,
I mean, like the, you know, the movement of people from Black River Falls, Wisconsin to the factories of Milwaukee and Chicago was, you know, an economic tropism. They were, you know, attracted there the way that a plant turns towards the sunlight. And I can foresee a situation where young people, you know, for one reason or another, will follow the economic promptings and imperatives of a very different economy.
It's interesting because when I look at, like here in Minnesota, a lot of the towns around me were all settled within a period of time by a certain wave of immigrants. So right. We have an area south of here that is full of German cities, and they were German Catholics, really, who came here for various reasons. Mm-hmm. You go a little bit further north, and you know, like my grandmother was Norwegian. I'm 3/4 Norwegian. There's a lot of Norwegian here, but even as you go further north, there were different settlements of Scandinavians. There's a joke a little bit north of here. You know, what do you call ethnic cleansing in Minnesota? It's a Swede, a Norwegian, and a Finn in a hot tub, right? So, you know, these places, you'd have a Finnish town next to a Swedish town, and they were, you know, you were in two very different places, even though, you know, for us today, those are all Nordics. Are we going to have waves like that? I don't know. We see a couple towns around here where you have had huge influxes of Hispanics, of largely of Mexicans, mm-hmm. Who have come for employment reasons. We've got one place where you've got a turkey plant, like a chicken, you know, processing facility, uh-huh. and they have thousands of Mexican immigrants that have moved there. To be part, you know, be part of that because it offers wages and opportunities and price points for living that make sense for those communities. Mm-hmm. Will we re-inhabit all these small towns in that way? I struggle with what I realize what will push them because economically this will make more sense, but how the mechanism will come about, it's not clear.
No, it isn't. And of course, you know, I think it's historically true that, you know, places do, you know, get settled. They grow up and then they, you know, contract and disappear. And there may be a lot of places that will disappear. You know, most settlements are where they are for geographic reasons. And you know, they're generally there because they occupy some sort of important site, whether it's a waterfall or a harbor or, you know, or a railroad track or something like that. But,
right.
You know, we'll see how that works out. I want to ask you about, you know, sort of a social phenomenon. I don't know about you up in Brainerd, Minnesota, but here in upstate New York, people seem to be increasingly cocooning in their homes, especially at night. You just can't get people to come out at night to do anything. I've been kind of involved in the contra dance scene here in upstate New York for the last few years because I play fiddle in a contra dance band. And the dances are all closing down all around the Northeast. You know, the Bennington, Vermont contra dance held its last dance last week. And it was kind of a sad occasion. And I'm wondering if you're seeing this inability to really maintain public life.
I'm part of that, the generation. I'm 42. I'm part of Generation X. And, you know, there have been all kinds of things written with Bowling Alone being kind of a seminal work about how, you know, as you get younger, you change the way people engage with their community. Uh-huh. I'll give you the one concrete example that I'm intimately aware of, and that has to do with my church. I'm Catholic. I go to church here in town. I'm not a very good Catholic, and I don't tend to go to these things myself. But I've watched the generation ahead of me, the generation a little bit older than me, struggle to organize things that I think they would call like hip and cool to try to overcome that phenomenon that you're talking about. Uh-huh. How do we get families out? And they'll do things like this weekend we have religion on tap, they're calling it. So there's a bar in downtown Brainerd that's not too seedy. And, you know, they bring someone in to do like a little Bible study on a Saturday night.
Well, that's a good feature of Catholicism, at least. They're, you know, they're in favor of drinking.
That's true. Yeah, we're not too prudish when it comes to consuming adult beverages on Saturday evening.
Yeah.
very true. So we they've got that planned, and you know, those have been modestly successful. Mm-hmm. You know, but they tend to not be, I think, the demographic they're searching for. They had a little, they called it the church bazaar. Where they had a day and they really did this big outreach. They tried to get people to just, you don't have to be Catholic, just show up. We're just going to have a fun time. No one's going to evangelize to you. We just want to get people together and have a big picnic. And again, the kind of branding on it was that the kind of branding you get from people in their late 50s and 60s who want to try to reach younger people, mm-hmm. but not the kind of branding you get from younger people when they're trying to reach each other.
Uh-huh. So it's kind of pathetic middle-aged branding.
Yes. And I hope none of these people are listening, because I love them. They're very kind, nice people, but yeah. they're, you know, they're trying to overcome a problem that I think is deeper than, you know, a picnic or a gathering at a pub can do.
Well, I'll give you an example of that, something that troubles me. You know, being involved in the contra dance scene, which is really kind of a lovely activity. I mean, you know, the human body in motion with beautiful live music, you know, it's really quite a lovely thing. There are even some of these places that are kind of historically very rigorous, where the, you know, the people dress up in 18th century costumes and everything. Mm-hmm. But what blows my mind is that the dances take place in these horrible, horrible rooms. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the one in Bennington took place in a, you know, kind of a scrapped, reconditioned, reused Howard Johnson's. Which had been, it had been turned into some kind of a, you know, nature visitor center for some piece of property, and but it was essentially just a big room with an acoustic tile ceiling with, you know, crappy fluorescent lights, and the room itself just had such a bad vibe, and I noticed that people really don't pay any attention to that. They're oblivious to the quality of the room. You know, by the same token, the town where my band is located is Cambridge, New York, and they have this wonderful old opera house called Hubbard Hall. And the main stage in there is, you know, it hasn't been changed in 100 years. There, you know, it doesn't have an acoustical tile ceiling. It's got a painted ceiling. It's got a balcony. It's got a proscenium stage. It's got a very adaptable audience seating area where you can, you know, you can move the seats around, put in cabaret tables, et cetera. But it's a beautiful room. It, you know, it's a room that actually has been adorned and decorated and embellished with some conscious artistry. And it makes such a difference to how you feel doing this activity in that room. So, just saying.
I totally hear you. And I had this conversation with our priest, which did not go over well. It didn't go poorly, but it wasn't as tough as confession, but it was received along those lines. You know, I said, you want to get people here, stop buying up the buildings around the church and turn them into parking lots. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. keep those buildings there, keep people there. Mm-hmm. You know, if we have a ministry to the poor, and you've got a building here that's kind of dilapidated, why don't we fix it up and let a poor family live there? I mean, what is the thing about a parking lot right outside this historic old cathedral kind of church? And, you know, that was not what the parishioners wanted. These same parishioners that are trying to get everybody to come to the picnic are also the ones who are, you know, kind of promoting destroying the neighborhood.
Yeah, they see the property adjacent to them as, you know, the highest and best value is parking. Yeah. And that's a cultural problem.
Exactly. Yeah. So we, you know, closed down the neighborhood school, which was built in the 1930s. With New Deal money, mm-hmm. and, you know, done in a very nice, like, classic style, mm-hmm. of, you know, has the auditorium, gym, you know, cafeteria combo, which they did in those buildings. So you could have voting in there, you could have community meetings in there, you could have theater and dance in there. And we closed that down, and the school district actually voted to rip it down until the public outrage forced them to sell to a charter school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we built a new sterile building out on, you know, 3 miles out of town, 4 miles out of town in a forest. You know, those are the kind of things that I think we've all become numb to. I mean, the new building's nice. It's shiny and new. It's got big windows, you know, but you project that one out 80 years. And you're not going to have anything like the quality of space that you've got in this one here, even if the location is still viable, which I find that hard to believe.
Sure. Well, Chuck, we're going to have to wrap this up now. And I want to thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
I look forward to seeing you in June at the Congress for the New Urbanism's annual meeting in Detroit, Michigan this year. So let's start publicizing that, maybe get some people there. And we will ride again.
Jim, thanks so much. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you in June as well. You take care.